This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you, Hans, for making time to meet with me here in your office for the East Area Democrats.
Wonderful to be with you, Chaco, and listeners.
Shall we jump straight in? What's been on the mind of, I think, the whole world is what's going to happen in America, and in particular, from your perspective, the Democratic Party, in the aftermath of Donald Trump winning the presidential election.
Well, there's a great concern amongst Democrats about not only the outcome of the election, but the process of the election, and certainly with the implications of the election on policy and on U.S. relationships with the rest of the world. In our election of November 8th, we sadly saw a majority of votes come out for the Democratic candidate, who ended up with an advantage of nearly 3 million votes. But nonetheless, because of our arcane and somewhat antiquated Republican system of government, where the Electoral College ultimately is the decider of our presidential elections, in that regard, Donald Trump emerged with a majority of votes under our Electoral College rules. So the concern amongst Democrats is twofold. It's over the direction of federal policy and the opportunities and threats in a wholesale confrontation with the incoming Trump regime, but it's also a great degree of internal reassessment based on some of the failures of Democratic messaging and organizing strategies that manifested themselves in places that are very familiar to me. I'm a Michigander by birth, and to see my home state tip very narrowly towards Trump with a vote total that was actually less than George W. Bush received in 2004 in losing Michigan is a really woeful signal and a wake-up call to Democrats that our organizing models and messaging needs to be overhauled, especially as we try to rebuild strong majorities in the deindustrialized Midwest and to build strong majorities in the popular vote, so much so that in 2020, perhaps, we can see a new or changed direction in the next presidential election.
Now, the people of California voted for Hillary, and there have been campaigns for California exit, Cal exit, and for a referendum that, if passed, would make California an independent country. How real is this possibility?
I don't think those are serious proposals that have any serious chance of proceeding, much less implementation. But what is noteworthy about California and our trend-setting role in a progressive direction for American politics and policy are some of the outcomes that we saw in our November 8th election here in California. Not only did we elect a woman of color to our vacant U.S. Senate seat, a woman with some South Asian heritage in Kamala Harris, to that seat vacated by Senator Barbara Boxer. But we also achieved a number of landmark victories in ballot measures here in California.
But where does California have to kowtow to federal laws or federal policies?
One area of great anxiety amongst Californians now is the progress that we saw through the Obama administration with the Deferred Action for Child Arrivals, which was implemented in 2012 and which actually granted the ability to stay in the country and continue working or going to school by hundreds of thousands of young people who came here with parents without proper documentation and in some cases never knew that they were out of alignment with immigration policy at the federal level. And because that policy was so studiously and scrupulously built by the Obama administration as a means of trying to jumpstart wholesale comprehensive federal immigration reform, we now see that pillar of progress and humane efforts towards immigration reform on the brink of dismantlement and jeopardy for the various people who sought refuge and inclusion under the policy. So that is an area where many Californians are extremely anxious right now, and where federal policy really does have a claw or a sort of Damocles over the heads of Californians under the new Trump regime.
A few days ago, U.S. intelligence and analysts concluded that Russia intervened to help Donald Trump win the U.S. election. How far is this true? Can you give us an update on investigations into this?
Well, I think if you look at the extremely defensive reactions of Trump and his supporters and his closest advisors to these accounts and the evidence supporting it, you'll see that it holds an alarming degree of validity, and they perhaps believe that it cuts to the very core of their claims to be legitimate winners of the presidential election. I don't think we are going to jeopardize that outcome, even though it's noteworthy that several members of the Electoral College, again, this body that actually decides the winner of the presidency, have asked for a briefing on the details of that Russian hacking. And recent reports that Vladimir Putin himself oversaw some of the hacking and the release of information from it, I think is deeply alarming, because we have never been in territory like this before, where we had international actors holding that kind of king-making role, if you will, in U.S. politics, and where it has cast such a very dark, and I would even say darkening, cloud over the legitimacy of Trump's election.
Now, you mentioned about Obama's legacy. Malaysia and other Pacific Rim countries were all set to participate in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. That is now not going to happen. Will all or most of Obama's achievements be dismantled like this? What would you think is Obama's legacy that will last?
Well, I think one thing that we should take heart in is that the spirit of diplomacy in the U.S. is not dead, although it may be endangered by the incoming regime. Some of the successes in achieving landmark progress against climate change and to prevent catastrophic global warming, those could survive even the Trump regime, although the Trump regime has threatened to remove the U.S. from participation in those climate protocols and the needed reforms to comply and to prevent the destruction of the global climate. So when people elsewhere, including Malaysians, look at the U.S., I think there's great hope to be taken, not necessarily from international accommodations and compacts like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but from the spirit of inclusion and attention to human rights that Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and President Obama and her successor John Kerry have sought to exert through U.S. diplomacy. And while the Trump regime threatens to remove consideration for human rights abuses or progress towards full inclusion and respect for diversity in countries with whom we negotiate, including on issues such as trade, I think that commitment is not dead amongst America, and it will rise again. That is one legacy.
Finally, just to round things off, what future plans and policies does California have going forward? How will the state government work with or possibly against Trump?
So while we saw a disappointing outcome at the presidential level, ultimately in the Electoral College, we saw a resounding support for progress on issues like climate protection, on eliminating sources of pollution, on demanding comprehensive federal immigration reform, on protecting women's right to choose, on reproductive health care, on the rights of LGBT people, in which California, even in the wake of the stinging defeat in 2008 on Prop 8, has in fact been a leader. So Californians have stood wholeheartedly on the path of progress, and I think we're going to see increasing demands that California's representatives in Congress, around which we actually happen to have an open seat emerging right now here in our congressional district, take a defiant stand and a progressive stand in pushing back on Trumpism and in demanding that California's vision and California's progress not be assailed, and that that be a path that we get back on as a country, Trump notwithstanding.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.